very jarring. And I'm like, hang on, wait a second. Are we at a disco?
Piper just, for you, this is an audio medium, so you don't know that Piper just did like a 60s, seven. What is this, 70s or 60s?
I think of it as the 70s. It's like, I think it's called like the Batman, when you move your two fingers in front of your eyes, like his mask.
And Piper did that involuntarily during the documentary while she was watching it. She was just doing the dances along with it.
You know, you gotta. Mm-hmm. If I talk to myself and laugh to myself, it shouldn't be a surprise that I dance with myself. Well, hello, Lillian. How are you today?
I am so good, Piper. How are you?
I am very good, too. I've got a lot of energy right now. I think it's fueled by this thunderstorm that is raging outside of my house. It's really given me good vibes, so I'm ready.
It was really dramatic first thing this morning. Like it was one of those, like, there's no break between the lightning and the thunder. The storm is at my house.
So cool. My house has, so our bedroom is like on the top level, which is like technically we're a 1.5. So it's like the attic was turned into the bedroom and there's not a lot of good insulation up there. So it's just like, you can hear the rain like assaulting the roof. And I'm just like, teehee, I'm warm and snug and it's fun in here. I love it.
That's great. That's wonderful. Well, and I think that a thunderstorm, we've talked about it before, that's the weather for the Brontes. And this week, we're not just talking about the Juan Bronte. We're talking about all three.
The Juan.
The Juan.
Yes, only three. The sisters, not Bran, poor guy.
Yeah, which, like, I had a whole moment the other day thinking about this where someone was saying, like, that Branwell... someone who's a listener, and we appreciate you, was saying that Branwell doesn't get as much notoriety as the sisters. And here's the thing, and I mean this in the nicest way possible, but like, he did not contribute as much as the sisters.
Yeah.
And if the roles gender-wise were reversed, I don't think people would be upset if like the Wright brothers had a sister who doesn't get as much credit for the plane. It's like, she didn't do the plane.
Right. Especially if most of her life was her, like, trying to sleep with other people's husbands, getting drunk and addicted to substances.
And it's not to say that his life isn't worth remembering or isn't important. It's just doesn't have as big an impact on culture and society as, you know, the Brontes.
Yeah, exactly. Wilbur and whatever the other guy's name is, they're like, Julia, will you get off the goddamn plane? We're trying to, like... be flying right now. And she's like, no, Dad says you had to take me.
Listen, I was bored at home and I ran out of booze.
This seems like a thrill. I need something like that.
Okay. Anyway. So we covered the Wright brothers, number one topic for this week's podcast.
Very important stuff. But yes, we're talking about a BBC documentary that is talking about itself.
Yes. We've done a lot of meta things on this podcast. This is the most meta thing we've ever reviewed.
Yes.
Which is, we are reviewing a documentary from 2016 that was reviewing the BBC's, that was on the BBC, that was reviewing the BBC's adaptations of the Brontes books and how that affected the UK's feelings about the Brontes books.
It was very much a snake eating its own tail situation.
For sure.
And it also kind of felt like, now that you say that it came out in 2016, because like, what year did the Jane Eyre that has Toby Stevens that everyone loves?
2006.
Okay, so it would have been 10 years after that. Okay, because I was like, wait a second, did they do this to promote that show? So it's just like a constant cycle of like, no. Never forget about the Brontes.
No, but it was like, they basically were like, the BBC would do Bronte adaptations and then Bronte dramatizations and then Bronte documentaries kind of constantly.
Yeah, like the one like you're watching now.
Between them, and you might be thinking to yourself, hey, this is a BBC Bronte documentary. And it's like, no, you can't. If you start to think about it too much, it makes your brain feel fuzzy.
But yeah, so this started, like, this documentary kind of goes from the very first adaptation that they made for TV and the kind of, like, through, like, how the culture in England was sort of changing three different decades, how the adaptations that they made kind of reflected those changes to like appeal to different audience mindsets. When there was like a dry spell of no Bronte content, and then when it came back again. So it was interesting to hear somebody else talk about multiple adaptations of Jane Eyre and like make comparisons, because I was like, hey, they're doing our thing.
Wrote, my second bullet in my notes is, this woman's coming for our job.
Yeah. And she was like inserting her own opinions on stuff too, which was fun. Like, obviously it was a script and they all agreed upon it, but like there were a couple of times when she's like, although Edward Rochester is much beloved, in this version he's rather creepy. And
truly, so the first adaptation they talk about is the 1956 Jane Eyre adaptation, which is available, but you have to physically travel to London to watch in film archives. So we have not been able to see it. So this was the most of it we got to see. They did put some clips in there, which was really fun. But she said, her description of the actors was, this Jane was this stage actress who is on this thing. And then Rochester was kind of creepy.
It's like, okay, it's like, how many Brontes have you watched? Because there's a lot of creepy dudes. Where's your bar?
And they did a lot of commentary. First of all, I want to say right off the bat, I really liked this documentary.
Me too.
My expectations for Bronte related documentaries, low. This documentary, if you like this podcast, you should watch this documentary. And if you're like, I would love to watch this documentary, Lillian, but it is impossible to pay for or stream for free on the internet. We didn't steal it. We found someone else who stole it. So yeah. Just go into the Jane Eyre Files Facebook group. And you can find, if you search Bronte's at the BBC, there'll be a post that'll show you how to get it. And we have no reason to believe any crimes were committed. And so technically we're innocent. I think that's how the law works.
Maybe as your lawyer, I would recommend that you stop talking.
Piper also became a lawyer over the summer. That's another thing that took up. That was why we did summer hours.
Well, you know, I watch a lot of Better Call Saul, so it's like I'm an expert.
It's sort of like how I'm a doctor because I've watched all the seasons of Grey's Anatomy.
This is how these things work, you guys.
I've invested the same amount of time in Grey's Anatomy as our friends who are doctors spent in medical school. So it feels like the same thing.
This is why the Wright brothers' sister thought she could also fly an airplane. Because she watched them do it. She's like, looks easy. Just to bring that back around.
Just to, because this is such a meta episode about a meta documentary, I do have to say, we had someone, most of the time people will say lovely things about how fun it is to have us laugh with them, but we did have someone on YouTube comment this week, grow up and stop laughing so much, and I almost said, I didn't respond, but I almost said, no.
No, never.
Why would I do that? That's not fun. This is fun.
This is how we have joy in our lives. I've always said, so I talk to myself a lot at my house because I work from home. Cool. I also talk to my cat. But then I also will like say things and then laugh at my own jokes. And I will always follow that insanity up by saying out loud, I'm like, well, if I can't make myself laugh, then what's the point? So I'm ready for that attic.
You've said from the beginning, we are our podcast's biggest fan.
Yes, it's very true. Okay, so we had this, the 50s TV, made-for-TV movie, Jane Eyre adaptation. And I think, honestly, one of my favorite things about this documentary.
I do think it was a miniseries. I'm pretty sure all of the Bronte BBC ones, unless they explicitly called them out, were all miniseries.
Okay, cool. Then I will use that term going forward. But I really loved how she talked about, like, gave the kind of historical context in which these were made. I think that was the most interesting thing for me. And so a big thing for this that stood out to me is that this was right after World War II. So people are, you know, pretty shook from that experience. kids. And they're like, well, what do we do when the world is sad? We look to the past and we escape through these kind of this idea, this lens of like a simpler time. And a detail that she mentioned that resonated with audiences then that I thought was really interesting is the fact that at the end of the story, Rochester has these injuries. He's blind. He loses a hand, or at least that's how he's supposed to be. And that how that would be kind of like relatable to wounded soldiers returning from the front and the women who love them. So that's really cool.
Yeah, it plays, that scene plays really differently because they contextualize that, and then they play the scene of Rochester after the fire kind of looking off into the distance, explaining to Jane why she doesn't want to be with him because he's no longer lovable, because he's no longer valuable, because he has these scars and these injuries. And watching that scene in the context of a lot of the people watching this are injured soldiers and the women in their lives, like that was so poignant. And I thought they did a really good, really balanced job of talking about how important and valuable that was, while at the same time talking about how Jane fit this 50s housewife stereotype in the adaptation and sort of lost some of the fire that we love about Jane.
Yeah. And yeah, I think that's the coolest thing. I kind of already said it, but I completely agree of like all of these, like, these are products of the time in which they are made. And it made me really think of like stuff that we talked a lot about when I was in my cinema classes in college, talking about specifically, this was referenced in my experience to like science fiction, about how it's always kind of a commentary on the way that things are in the time that the story is written, even though it's often like setting things into like a far distant future. And that's like a similar thing that you're seeing here. It's just reversed for the past of kind of altering how maybe somebody would have behaved in these settings to fit the expectations or the hopes or desires of the current audience watching it.
And I think it fits really well, both the documentary and the way that we look at not only these stories, but the Brontes themselves and the way we talk about these women. This was a really interesting documentary to watch, thinking about that, which we've contextualized that so many times as we talk about the podcast, we talk about different adaptions on the podcast, but there's also this layer of, for me, particularly when we talk about feminism and the role women play, the way that all of these adaptions are portraying Jane as this modern woman. Like they talked about it a lot. They kept saying like, well, in this one, she was more like this. In this one, she was more like this. And when it got to the 60s, they were more like, Jane was this modern woman. And I'm like, but it's truer to the Jane in the book than the 50s one. But you're saying that as if this is now new and different. And I think it reminded me of a couple of things that I find really important. One, the how kind of progressive, and I think there's the inherent truths in an honest representation of women in the 1847. We often think of, this ties into the next point, which is we often think of progress as really linear, that like women didn't have as many rights and now they have more rights and it just continues until we're all equal. And I think this really highlighted for me how that's not inherently true. And that we have to be stewards of that change if we want that progress to continue towards equality. Because while Victorian women clearly had fewer rights than women in the 1950s, there are other areas where Victorian women had different kinds of perceptions put on them. Of what they were capable of. They ran households in big business kind of ways, like not just, they were running, managing staff and people and all that stuff. And that wasn't seen as something that women were capable of in the future. So that's my feminist pedestal that I'm not putting away because it's going to come up again.
I was going to say, keep it out, because that's like kind of the driving conversation of this entire documentary, I think. So we then go from the success of that miniseries to then the BBC people decide, okay, what else can we tap into? This was really good. Let's do it again. And so then they went on to do their adaptation of Wuthering Heights.
And they did do a documentary about Charlotte Bronte in between.
Okay.
But then they did the Wuthering Heights is the next one worth talking about, really.
And I thought it was so interesting that when they did that one, they took inspiration from a like Hollywood American-made movie version that had come out prior that had been very successful. And like I think they mentioned like was nominated for like Oscars or something.
Yeah, and so, it was 39 that came out, and it had sort of proliferated people's understanding of Wuthering Heights.
Right. So to kind of like meet that expectation, they kind of modeled theirs after the Hollywood version. And it's interesting, all these behind the scene things. Like they talked about how the one that was made in America was filmed because they didn't have the Moors there. They used like this ranch in California to make these kind of big vistas and hilly scenes to have the couple running through nature. And so they, instead of in this production, the BBC, instead of actually going to the Moors that are there in their own country, they just like made a soundstage that looked like the hills of California, which I think is very fascinating to be like, look, it's the Moors, but it's the California take on the Moors.
Yeah, that was like, so what you're saying is they did it in California and they just went outside with what they had, and you're in England.
Yeah.
Like those are, they're outside. If you go outside, that's what it looks like.
Yeah.
Okay.
I guess it's more expensive to get your crew in a bus and drive them out there than it is to build a set. I don't know.
Yeah. And there was a couple of things they specifically said in this, which was so funny to me. I'm so glad that we watched Wuthering Heights. I'm pretty sure. So this was recommended to us by someone whose names I could not find to put in my notes. So thank you, listeners. Everyone who ever contributes to this podcast, we couldn't do without you. but I do want to say they did recommend that we watch Wuthering Heights first. And I'm so glad that we did because, they really talk about Wuthering Heights probably as much as Jane Eyre, but they do say some of my favorite things was Soulmates were dominating the charts. And I out loud went, so you did Wuthering Heights?
I know, right? Like, yikes. But they did.
Oh, no.
But they talk about how, because like the Hollywood version also kind of toned down the gothic elements and focused just on their love story. And so this one also did that, which like now that we've seen the full story, can you imagine if you are a fan of Wuthering Heights and you find out they're going to adapt it into a movie or a miniseries and you're like, sweet, I can't wait. And they cut out half the story to make it more of a like romance that general audiences will love. That's like gutting a piece of artwork and putting a hashtag on it and being like, look, it's popular. And it'd be like, what the hell are you doing?
It's like, there's so many things that make that so funny to me. But I think that's funny to imagine, of course. But the other one that's really funny to imagine is, what if you watched that movie or that miniseries where it sounds like, so we haven't seen it, obviously, but it sounds like this one cuts off when Kathy dies very shortly after that Heathcliff dies. Mm-hmm. And the monster that is Heathcliff really comes to life after Kathy dies.
Yes.
And so if you watch this and you were like, oh, tragic romance, better go read the book.
Oh, you'd be so messed up.
Or like if you were a parent and your kid decided to read, like your 13-year-old went to read this book, like, oh my God.
Yikes. Oh my gosh, seriously.
So funny. The other thing, I wrote down a couple of quotes that they had in the script, which just felt deeply British to me. One, they said the unrestrained nature of Emily's work. LOL to that. The shirt, that's one way of saying this bitch was batshit crazy and we love it. And then the next line was, they weren't ready. They weren't ready for the unrestrained nature of Emily's work in 1962, you know, 115 years after it came out.
Seriously. It's like, no, people have been reading this book forever. Just go pick it up and you'll get your socks knocked off. But not for television.
I think we're all Charlotte. I'm just picturing the people in 1962 being Charlotte Bronte in the 2022 Emily movie where she reads the book and then collapses in the kitchen going, why would you do this?
Right. right? No, it's so good. I don't know if it was after this version or if it was a later version that they talked about, but they showed this clip of this like woman who like I assume was like a reporter for the BBC or a commentator, and she like went to the parsonage to go talk about things. And she's like, it's a very cute, awkward interview, but she's like kind of making assumptions about Emily Bronte. And she's like, well, we have no proof that she ever actually was in a relationship or experienced these things. But if you read the book, you can't really deny she was a passionate lady. <She's> like, yep, good job, lady. You said it.
It's just so funny. It might have, there's so many different documentaries they mentioned. I could not keep them all straight. And they kept using like BBC terms. Mm-hmm. So like, if you know all the BBC things, or like are a big fan of all these BBC documentaries, I Googled some of them, but there was like the Quaker Mass experiment was like a documentary series thing. Mm. Or no, that was a sci-fi show because he was the one who did the 62 Wuthering Heights adaptation. So they said that like he was this huge famous man. I believe him that he was famous and people knew who he was. But there was like, it was cut in documentaries. The note that I have for the document, one of the documentaries, this one is actually after the 76 one, but similar vibe of like British documentaries about the Brontes went real off the rails because they had to find new things to say.
Yeah.
They had a grave digger on one of the documentaries who they made it seem like he was digging up old graves to tell them about how many people died. And then they like zoom, they did this whole cut where they like zoom out and they're in the Brontes home. So you could like see that man out of their nursery window.
Yeah.
And I was like, dark, guys.
They're like, hey, do we have permission to go dig around in the cemetery? And it's like, well, George is burying someone this afternoon. I guess you could interview him. And it's like, sweet, we'll do that.
And then that man had the thickest, whatever the accent of that region was, I could not understand a word he was saying. That was a different language.
Neither could I. I was like, the interviewer's like, uh-huh, and then what? And he's like,
and I'm not saying we don't have accents. I'm saying his accent, I generally understand British accents. I can do Irish ones really well and most Scottish accents I can follow. But whatever that man, whatever his regional accent was, could not follow it.
No clue. So then they talk about the adaptation of Anne's story, which is the tenant of...
Can we talk about the tenant happened after the 67 one. Can we talk about the 67 one?
Do it.
Okay, the Wuthering Heights 67 one, they basically did a significantly truer adaptation of Wuthering Heights. Mm-hmm. What it was the guy who played Heathcliff in that? He looked like a Piper potato face boy.
Oh, if that's the one I'm thinking about, it was Ian McShane.
Yes.
Who is a Piper guy. I like that man. He's big and scary with a cool voice.
But they actually filmed it on the landscape where Emily wrote it because they did realize it was just up the road. And it was, quote, less sentimental and settled on the passion.
Yes.
So they were really focused on the passion. And apparently people who had only known the 62 adaptation were very surprised when halfway through the adaptation, Kathy dies and there's all this other stuff after it. And they actually go into all of these like really rough things that are in the book. And people are like, what the hell? And they're like, that's the book.
Yeah.
Like, to be clear, we're right.
I love it. And I loved how they were like, it was the summer of love in London. And then it just cuts to like Kathy and Heathcliff rolling around in the grass. It's just like, so we put that in our movie. They're like, this has to be passionate, full of love in the wilderness.
Well, and it also contextualizes for me too, like that scene, so that didn't have the scene of them romantically on the moors. And the 50s, the original 39 from Hollywood and the 62 one both had that. Mm-hmm. And the adaptation we watched from the 90s had that.
Yeah.
And I just love that, like, I think of Wuthering Heights, like, I think of that as Wuthering Heights. And the idea that wasn't in the book is so funny to me. Like, that's why,
yeah,
talking about these adaptations and how it's the snake eating its own tail is so mm-hmm. fun for me.
Yeah, because the narrator said that she's like, this became kind of like iconic iconography mm-hmm. related with the story, even though Emily never like described the setting that way. Mm-hmm. So interesting.
So interesting.
I feel like it is safe, since so many of the stories are semi autobiographical. I mean, just in the sense that they like took inspiration from like their settings and like the people that they knew and stuff. I think it's safe to assume, because they lived near the moors, that that would be a location that she would be pulling inspiration from.
Oh, for sure. And I'm sure they had description, like some level of description of the moors, but the way that they have Heathcliff and Kathy, to me, are so tied to the physical surroundings and like mm-hmm. standing out on the moors. I'm curious as to what specifically is in the book.
Yeah.
Because if it's truly like Heathcliff's wild spirit being tied to the wildness of the moors, I think that's in the book.
That
so
right.
Someone who knows more about Wuthering Heights than us, send us a message. Tell us what that's about. Now so let's talk about forgettable Anne.
Yes, poor sweet lady. The Tenant of Wildfell Hall is her mm-hmm. book that they adapted. And it was a big deal that it was the first one in color. So way to go, Anne. You're not
yeah.
forgotten. In fact, you got a landmark feature to your adaptation. So that's so interesting to hear and learn about her story and its different like takes, because I know nothing about that story, mm-hmm. And I know very little about Anne. And so it's very interesting that, because we learn that this is kind of the story of like a woman who is like trapped in this awful abusive marriage. Her husband's like an alcoholic, and the way that the different stories kind of portray what that abuse looks like and what her strength looks like in how she kind of defies her husband or stands mm-hmm. up to her husband, which is very interesting to see. I think that was one of the bigger things. I mean, obviously the change in Wuthering Heights is the biggest change between these different versions, but it was very interesting to see that from like the 60s to then the one that came out in the 2000s.
Yeah. And I think that what they did a really good job in this documentary of was contextualizing it, because the BBC, I think it has more impact culturally in the UK than PBS does here.
Yeah.
Like that was for a long time, the BBC One now, like the primary BBC, was like the only channel in the UK for a really long time. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously we talked about the fact that some of these, like the 67 and the 68 Tenant of Wildfell Hall, like those, the both came out on BBC Two, which was one of those things where I'm like, ooh. Ooh, a thing I don't understand, but I'm sure it's totally different, and I believe you.
It kind of sounded like maybe that was like their masterpiece classics, like kind of like separate channel, and like versus like maybe the other one was more like news and drama and stuff. I don't know. I'm just guessing.
It felt like they could be more rebellious on BBC Two, and mm-hmm. they could do what they wanted to. But if any of our listeners, especially those of you who maybe were around in that time or shortly thereafter, who have a better understanding of what that means and why we should care about it, please feel free to tell us.
Yeah.
but the specific thing that tied directly into this adaption was there was a lot of conversation about divorce law mm-hmm. in the UK at that time, and yeah. they were making it, I don't know. I know what we would call it here in the US, but like no fault divorce was becoming a thing mm-hmm. where you could get divorced by just saying our relationship isn't working anymore versus like this person tried to murder me.
Right.
Which all in all, I've seen statistics about it. More women live. So big fan of no fault divorce.
The couple that they interviewed, they showed an interview.
So funny.
Of this like couple like grocery shopping with their daughter. And like then it cuts to them like being interviewed about like why they want to get a divorce. And the lady is like, well, I want to have a bunch of children. We only have the one. And he doesn't want to have like kids with me anymore. And it cuts to the guy and he's like, I feel like we're not able to take care of this one child, so we shouldn't be bringing more into the world. And I'm like, yes, agreed. And then it cuts to that little girl being like, what? I'm like, oh my God.
It was so funny. They were like, yeah, we think we should get divorced because we don't really like each other anymore. We're not really nice to each other. And then they're like, tell us more about your marital problems. And she's like, I don't know, like an example is I want more kids. And he's like, and I think we're too unhappy and bad parents. So we probably shouldn't have more.
So let's not do that.
Their adorable pigtailed daughter just like picking up cereal.
Yeah, I know, right?
Another thing they did throughout this documentary that became more and more jarring as it was like things that I recognized.
The music.
Is they would put music over it. They would put the music of the time over clips of the adaptations. Mm-hmm. So it was like Wuthering Heights, but with 60s rock music over the top of it.
Yeah.
And it was like the 50s adaptation with 50s music over it didn't catch me. But every time they did it after that, I was like, this is well done. It does a really good job of making you think about this period drama as contextualized in the time that it exists. Mm-hmm. Please never do it again.
It's very jarring. And I'm like, hang on, wait a second. Are we at a disco?
Piper just, for you, this is an audio medium, so you don't know that Piper just did like a 60s, what is this, 70s or 60s?
I think of it as the 70s. It's like, I think it's called like the Batman, when you move your two fingers in front of your eyes, like his mask.
And Piper did that involuntarily during the documentary while she was watching it. She was just doing the dances along with it.
You know, you gotta. Mm-hmm. If I talk to myself and laugh to myself, it shouldn't be a surprise that I dance with myself.
They did one thing that I happen to know exists that they just skipped right on over in this documentary was there was a 1963 adaptation of Jane Eyre that I believe, like Villette, which we'll talk about here in a second, the film, at least for a couple of the episodes, has been lost.
Yeah. And I get it. I mean, like, it's hard to talk about things for a long time if you don't have a lot of stuff for it. They had screenshots. They had, like, photos taken from that movie that they showed.
Nice. They did that with Villette, for sure, which was this 1971.
Gotcha.
And they talked about that one didn't survive the archives and is a little bit more – is the most autobiographical of all of them.
Right.
Specifically talking about Charlotte's experience falling in love with her professor, which mm-hmm. – I have heard from listeners that particularly, I believe it was Paula who reached out to us and said after one of the episodes where we were talking about Charlotte wanted Rochester to be punished and that's why he was blind for a little bit. She's mm-hmm. like, read Villette. You're right on.
Oh, nice. Awesome.
She was mad.
Am I mistaken that the next one is the 70s Jane Eyre adaptation?
So there's two quick adaptations. So there's the Villette one, which, mm-hmm. as we mentioned, they had archived. Yeah. Then they did their most popular of all the Bronte-related miniseries was a 1973, The Brontes Live Here, mm-hmm. which was a biographical drama. So mm-hmm. they, instead of doing another documentary, they did and I think they filmed it in a lot of the locations where they lived, and they talk about, like, the clip they showed was them finding out about publishing their books and all of that stuff. So I don't know how we get access to that, but I want to see that now.
Yeah, that'd be fun. I like that.
But that came out the same year as the Jane Eyre 1973 with Michael Jaston and – name of actress.
Which, by the way, okay, so here's the comment I was going to say earlier when we were off air. So it's getting to like the 70s and 80s adaptations, and they're like, so the BBC returned to Jane Eyre. And I don't know why, I think my brain just, like, you know, blipped out for a second, because like the film quality looks similar, and like they showed the exterior of Thornfield, and I thought it was the 80s one, and I literally out loud I was like, yay, and then they show his face, I'm like, boo. Like, oh no, wait, wrong one.
I, on the other hand, said yay and then yay again because I was excited. Because it is so interesting when you set the 73 in the context of where it lived. Mm-hmm. It really was they said the 83 is the purest adaption, which, like, if you include outfits, I cannot argue with you there. But I think that the 73 really was the first one to attempt to tell the whole story, and didn't skip over the childhood and didn't steer away from her time with St. John, which I do recommend people do, and really kind of went into all of that and showed – this is another one where they were like, Jane was a modern woman. I was like, more – Jane was more accurate to the book that came out in 1847.
Yes. Yeah. But then people like relate with that. It's like you know, I don't know, you're like casting yourself into that moment.
Yeah. And I think it's certainly interesting to think about how that this is what I really loved about this documentary is like they started with this people are sad and we have got to give them something to be less sad about. We just got out of a war.
Yeah.
And that's what they, so they sort of softened the Bronte movie, the Bronte books in creating these movies to give something that was romantic and lost the gothic elements and just was comfortable and cozy for people. And to see how that changed to telling the story of Jane Eyre, because the story of Jane Eyre accurately was more relevant
and human. Yeah. No, it was really cool to hear them talk about that. It was like after this point, right, when they kind of get into this area where they're talking about how like England was kind of going through like an economic recession. So again, people are turning to these areas for comfort and nostalgia in the past. But then they really talked about how like the town where the Brontes lived, where like before in the 50s when like a BBC documentary crew went to film it, they're like, oh, look, it's so bleak and empty and morbid and tombstones. And now it's like a bustling tourist attraction where like all these English people are coming, people from other places of the world are coming because it's like kind of revitalized this interest in like the Brontes and their novels. People are reading the books more. And then like, yeah, it becomes sort of this tourist location. And it was really funny to hear some of the interviews they did of like this one guy who was like seemed very like anti-gentrification. And he's like, yes, it's like, exactly, well, these used to be houses that people lived in and now they're shops and they're selling stuff made in Hong Kong and like all this stuff. And I'm like,
which like
whatever
fair criticism.
Yeah.
Like simultaneously a fair, because if you imagine your family lived there for generations, and then all of a sudden your house becomes like somebody comes and offers you twice what your house used to be worth because they want to turn it into a knickknack shop for tourists.
Yeah.
For why? and it's not like it was always that, because Jane Eyre became popular immediately after it was published.
Right.
So Charlotte Bronte was always famous. Not in a way where she walked down the street and people knew who she was, but like, it's not like Charlotte Bronte became famous overnight in 1970.
Yeah.
But her house did.
Yeah.
I
loved the fact that because so many tourists were like walking through the house, that they had to like reinforce it with like steel beams because they're like, it became structurally like unstable with that many people passing through this like tiny little house that was made for humans who were much smaller back then.
Incredible. I loved that. And also just how many people went through that house, which, by the way, I know we have at least one listener who works at the Parsonage Museum. Hi, we love you.
Hello. Thanks for tuning in.
Someday I'll get there. It's just very far away from where I live. I can't just take a bus like these people.
And Lillian was a fantastic swimmer, but that's even pretty far for her. So
yeah, still am. I still do a good job of swimming, not through the ocean.
Me on her back especially.
Yeah, it's like I could maybe do it alone, but Piper on my back not helping at all.
Well, I'm holding the microphones and all of our podcast equipment above the waves and I'm like, we can't get this wet.
Got one hand on that and one hand eating snacks is what I'm picturing, just being like, let's go faster, this is heavy.
But then when you're hungry, I'll put a gummy in your mouth, I'll give you some snacks and I'll help you out with that, unless you want to just catch a fish while you're swimming. Because I believe in you, Lillian. Well, you just filter your food through your Bailey.
given that's the free option we have, I think we're probably going to save up for flights.
We would be amazing if we did it the other way. Because it's totally possible. We're not just joking around, guys. But we can't show you. It's too cool.
If we die in the process, it was worth it.
Oh, my God.
It was for our art.
So then we get the, I'm sure there's other stuff. I just want to talk about the 80s one. Is there other things in between there that we need to touch
really
on?
Really quick through some of the items. There was a man they interviewed about the Brontes who said that they were good, clean stories. And that man can fuck right off.
Well, he's like, oh, yes, they wanted because none of this filth or sex that's on television. He's like, these were romantic and they were passionate, but they were clean and respectable. And it's like, okay, guy, there's a lot of sex. You just got to read between the lines.
It's okay that you don't that you've never had sex before. And so you don't understand the references. We forgive you. I bet you also think the Red Room's just about a room being red. but another one was they had another Wuthering Heights adaptation that got rough in the 70s.
Yes. Okay. We have to talk about this.
Here's the line that I must talk about, which is the documentary or the narrator for the documentary said that Heathcliff was, quote, being creepy with Kathy's corpse. And then they made me watch that.
Yeah. No. Okay. So that guy went all out. I think they mentioned that he was like Scandinavian, like the actor or something. The imagery that they used in that one, which I think Wuthering Heights is the perfect story to get like super avant-garde and like weird like indie kind of European film. That is totally the movie that you should do that with. But yes, we see him like they do the scene where like he has Kathy's like grave dug up and he pulls open the coffin lid and the gravedigger is up there and he's like, yeah, that's gonna sour real fast once the air touches it, sir. We should cover this up. And he's all like, oh, let me kiss the corpse.
And, like, and then he does.
Yeah. And then like when for the scene at the end when the guy who's visiting like goes into that room and sees the ghost, they did this cool creepy thing where he had like a candle held between his fingers, but it's like burned down to the wick, so his hand is covered in wax, and it's just like, ooh, this is very creepy and upsetting and feels very right for this character.
It I think it's really interesting. I don't know that I have the energy to do what we've done with Jane Eyre for Wuthering Heights.
No.
But it does look like it would be a cool one to do it with, because even just the three adaptations we saw in this documentary all tell an incredibly different story in ways that are inaccurate uniquely. And accurate in unique ways.
Yeah.
And I think it's really, really interesting. And if you want to watch this documentary because you wish that we would do, I can't watch Heathcliff that many times. I really don't think I have it in me, guys.
He would break my heart too much violence.
Yeah, it would be a rough go of it. But they then did a Blue Peter special, which they said it was the biggest deal that anything's ever happened. And I'm going to need somebody to email me about why I should care. Cause I Googled it and it seems like a documentary series.
Yeah. So there you go. But maybe it's got like significant importance to people there culturally, but they made a point that they were like, this is like a family friendly content that they followed up that horrifying thing with. So,
and they had a very classic British documentary line, which all of my stereotypes of British documentaries really came through watching this, which was a man was standing in front of the Brontes' house and he was saying to camera, this was where, was it Patrick, the dad's name? Patrick Bronte, Mr. Bronte, man, person.
This is where Daddy Bronte.
Daddy Bronte moved in with his six children and his wife. In 35 years' time, all those children will be dead.
Yes! And I'm like, yeah, man, bring us down. That was supposed to be the happy family-friendly one.
You can't tell the story of the Brontes' lives without the tragedy of their deaths.
Of course.
But truly, I'm gonna need an American documentary about the Brontes that ends with the positive montage of young girls reading Jane Eyre and Wuthering Heights and Tenant of Wildfield Hall,
yeah,
and the positive impact these people had forever, because these men keep bumming me out.
Yeah. It'll be all of that, but it'll also just come with a little bit of capitalism because they'll be like, and here's Jane Eyre enjoying a nice Coca-Cola. Ooh, refreshing.
It'll be like, it'll give us stats on the success of it, not by the impact on people, mm-hmm. but instead by the dollars.
Yes, exactly.
That's there the we go. Only, listen, life's a game and money's the points.
The American way. So then they bring in Timothy Dalton, God yes. bless. And they mentioned, they gave him props for having a more convincing horse fall scene. I loved how much she was like roasting other people. She was like, he just fell off his horse for no reason in those other versions. But in this one, he fell off for a good reason. It was very believable. Mm-hmm. And she also, so she talked about how that was like the most like true to the book of like using mm-hmm. actual lines and using a lot of the scenes that is usually
and
avoided.
Not cutting things out.
Like the gypsy scene, which she was like, she's like, they chose to use this where other versions very wisely cut this scene out.
In the fortune teller scene, she's, yeah, specifically wisely cut it out. I was like, cowards, only cowards cut the exactly. fortune teller scene out.
Like, if you can't love Rochester in his drag, then you can't love him with all of his money in his normal clothes.
Shortly after that, she said the second line that I wrote down, which was, they were very faithful and did a really good job of adapting it beat for beat, line for line. And then she said, arguably too well.
Right, because then they didn't make any versions for like 10 or 15 years. Like, mm-hmm. it just kind of dropped off after that point. Because then we're getting into like the 90s and people are more like, oh, we don't care about the past. Everything's going good now. Pop culture, Spice Girls, Princess Di, all this jazz. Yeah, so they're partying they were, and they leave that behind for a bit.
The 80s were too happy. The early 90s continued to be too happy. And then the narrator sexually harassed Colin Firth from the past.
Incredible. That was so goddamn good. Although beforehand, wasn't it that they talked about how like people were splitting up again. And so then they talked about the Tenant. Or did...
No, that was after.
Okay, so
they
yes.
said they Pride and Prejudice and Tenet of Wildfield Hall came out the same year. Mm-hmm. Yes. But Pride and Prejudice was slightly before that. And she talks about the fact... She really hits hard that they started casting attractive actors. Mm-hmm. And I just would like to say they never stopped casting attractive actors. Yes. Everyone who has ever played these roles, other than maybe... Heathcliff from the 70s were hot. They were all hot.
She's just like, I guess this woman's standards are, it's got to be Colin Firth?
Yes, Firth? Colin okay. Firth, wet shirt, like see-through, sexy bedroom eyes.
He obviously did it for her, and I guess for a lot of other people, because, yeah, they're like, oh, wait, these are sexy and fun again. Let's go back to these period dramas. Mm-hmm. So they bring those back, and... In this era of like the kind of early aughts of talking about these adaptations, because these are the ones I'm less familiar with, but these are the ones I was really intrigued by.
Let's
so that's kind of
about really quick before we get to the early aughts. Let's talk about the 95 Tenant of Wildfield Hall.
Oh, is okay. That's what I was going to go for. Sorry, mixing decades. You're up. Great. But yeah, so like, because again, we're like, it's a big deal in the news that like a lot of famous celebs are breaking up, and she mentions a boy band that split up that I guess is a big deal for people.
Take That, which I only know, just so people in the UK know, I personally only know this because it was a big deal on Dairy Girls.
Okay, gotcha. Which is a great show. Love it.
Fantastic show.
But also like, I'm sorry if I'm about to offend people who love the royal family and all this stuff, but they're like, oh, there are so many heartbreaking like split ups, like Princess Di and that ugly rat faced man that she was married to. And I'm like, they showed them together. I'm like, oh God, how did she stay with that dude? He looks so weird.
Which like, to be fair, so I am arguably too into the royal family's history, but Princess Di can do no wrong. Please come at me. And Charles, she was making him look better until we realized that he had groomed her and treated her really poorly and arguably abusive. And he's the king now. And I'm not going to make commentary on what the whole royal situation is, because it's your country and you can do what you want. But all I'm saying is we were right in the Revolutionary War, because otherwise... Charles would also be our king.
USA. USA.
We've got not a lot going for us, but he's not our king.
Yay. Okay, so yeah, so then they do the tenant of what's it called, Hall again, and it's a much more like kind of darker look at the spousal abuse that she suffered.
Yeah.
Which I wonder if that is like hinted at in the book or if that was creative liberties that they took to kind of make it be like, you know, this isn't just a lady being demure because her husband is mean. He's like actually bad, and let's talk about why.
It sounds like it was more true to the book, which makes sense to me that the first one they did was softer and then they got more true to the book, brought in more of the gothic elements. The domestic violence got more real. The scene where he's like kissing her hand and then bites her hand.
Yeah.
Rough.
Yeah. Very rough. But then, okay, so the thing that they then talked about next that I am the most intrigued by, and I definitely want to look this up, is this modern day retelling of Wuthering Heights where they swap the gender roles.
Yes. Before we move to that, I have one more thing on the 95, which is just, did you recognize the man who played her happily ever after man at the end?
Oh, yes. It's Toby Stevens.
Toby Stevens is in that.
He was just auditioning for Rochester.
And I was very annoyed by their use of the word girl power then, which, like, I get it. We were alive in the 90s. I understand. Girl power was girl boss. I get it.
Yep.
I still don't like it.
Nope.
Let's talk about the 2001 Spark House movie.
Yeah. So this looks fascinating. And they mentioned a like female director or writer whose name sounded really familiar to me. So I'll have to go back and look that up. But that just looks fascinating. I definitely have to check that out. And I love the idea of taking classic literature and like switching the gender roles and kind of like almost as like an exercise to kind of look at the things to be like, okay, if a woman does this versus a man, how does that feel to us? And why is that different? And vice versa. So we got to see female Heathcliff like standing on top of a car with an axe, like destroying the windshield and just being psycho. And I'm like, well, that's interesting. And they gave... like it, for every version that they talked about with Wuthering Heights, they talked about how important Kathy's speech is, where she's like, Heathcliff is me. And so it's interesting to see a guy talk about that instead for his female love. So yeah, I'm definitely going to check that out. That's fascinating.
It's also fun to watch a woman be the villain and be crazy and abusive, because women, true equality is women being able to be crazy and abusive too.
Sure.
Just kidding. That was a joke.
But yeah, so they did that. And then what am I missing? I got some blanks here before we jump into the final Jane Eyre.
I think the final Jane Eyre is the next one. They talked a lot about how the early 2000s were softer and nicer and girl bossified and just so much sexier. Mm-hmm. After Colin Firth, everything got sexier, according to this documentary.
Yeah. And they also mentioned that that's kind of how they brought us into the 2006 Jane Eyre. They give us the scene where he's like asking her to stay by like stroking her collarbones and laying in the bed and all that
sexy
stuff.
Which I'll give them that one. That was that's the sexiest stay scene.
It is very sexy. I really liked how, so in this part, she really talked a lot about how she was like, this Jane was a modern woman. You know, she stood up for herself and asked questions and all this stuff. And again, like you've been saying this whole time, it's like, yep, that's Jane in the actual novel back in the day. But then what they really talked about in this, which I think is good to...
Sorry, I do want to pause just for a second, because I did look up that author that you were talking about, the writer of the 2001 movie and the gender swap. Guess what you know her from?
I have no idea. That's why I don't...
Gentleman Jack! She wrote Gentleman Jack! She's the writer-creator of that.
Amazing.
Okay, sorry. I had to get that in and I was going to forget.
Hooray! But yeah, no, they talked about how they made this Rochester more sympathetic to appeal. Like, the way she phrased it was interesting. They're like, they made a Rochester that was worthy of this, like, new modern, like, independent Jane. Mm. And that translates to the Toby Stevens, like, he's more of a soft boy. He's more apologetic and forthcoming with his faults. They give him the tragic backstory with actual pictures and images of, like, Bertha cheating on him and all these sympathetic things. And so it's like, I'm glad that she at least like kind of mentioned that, where it's like, yes, this is a version that is easy to love for a lot of reasons, but it changes a lot from the original text. And so, you know, purists versus like, oh, but I want to like him kind of a thing. It's that whole debate there.
Well, and I think what was interesting to me about is they framed it like they made Jane more modern, so they had to make Rochester more worthy of that. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the truest Janes. Mm-hmm. So I think it was more if making Rochester worthy of who Jane was the whole yeah. time.
He has to meet her 1700 standards. Yeah.
Yeah. 1847, not 1700s.
Never remember these dates.
It's the 17th 1541. Century, but you're like, numbers from the past.
I don't do numbers, baby. I'm a visual person. I do words and sounds.
But they kept saying things that, like, I get that it's for the narrative that they're telling in this documentary, but they did specifically say he wants a 21st century woman. And I'm like, I mean, no, yes and no.
Yeah, kind of.
Because as much as that's true, I think because they do go into this at the very end. This is the note they hit at the very end, which is they are talking about how universal these stories are, mm-hmm. because they do make changes, and it's interesting to see what changes they make depending on the time. Mm-hmm. But part of the reason the adaptions are so different is not necessarily that they're making fundamental changes to the text, but rather they're focusing on the things in the text that are more relevant to the time.
Yeah.
But if you pull the whole thing out, all of it's relevant all the time.
Yeah.
You just have to make choices when you're making an adaptation. Mm-hmm. And so that's why the focus is on different moments in the story and different ways to understand who Rochester is. Because we've talked about the fact that, yeah, Toby Stevens is the softest way to interpret Rochester. Mm-hmm. But it's not inherently inaccurate.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's parts of the way he treats Bertha that are inherently inaccurate. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, it's just establishing a tone that's softer than yeah. some of these other tones.
Exactly. It's kind of like what we've talked about a lot, where it's like with books like these that have so much content, you can kind of decide how you want to tell the story and mm-hmm. still, yeah, like you say, just kind of pick and choose.
It reminds me a lot. These books are so relevant still, I think, for the same reasons. I can't remember who it was. It could have been Taylor Swift, but honestly, it could be anyone. Some songwriter, I saw an interview of them where they talked about how often they will write songs that are deeply personal about very specific things that happened in their life. Mm-hmm. And they used to worry that they wouldn't be as relatable to people, but they found over time that the more specific, the more personal you write it, ultimately, the more universal that experience and art becomes, mm-hmm. because you're representing something that is a deep truth about humanity. Yeah. And I think that that's what these books have, and that's what these adaptations and why they've been adapted so many different times, even just by the BBC, mm-hmm. because they're always relevant because they're representative of deep truths about humanity, even the ones we'd rather not look at too closely.
Yeah.
Sometimes people kiss dead bodies, and I don't want that to be true. And that's not the part of the story I would focus on.
But it's real, and people need to see it.
People gotta know.
And face that ugliness right in the eye.
Sometimes marriage is bad, and women are trapped. And mm-hmm. divorce is good in those cases.
Yay.
Anyway.
I don't think I could follow up a better analysis than what you just said, so let's wrap it up. Should we rate this documentary?
I don't think we rated the last one, or if we did, it was a rough situation.
Let's just do a thumbs up or a thumbs down. We'll do it. Okay. What's that guy's name? I don't even remember. It was
Branwell?
No. I'm thinking of like Roger and Ebert, the film critics. They would always two thumbs up, two thumbs down.
Okay. So we're both just at the screen going to, at the same time, do a thumbs up or a thumbs down.
Yes. Okay. Ready and go.
Yay! Two thumbs up!
Two thumbs up from Piper and Lillian.
And just because my thumb is abnormally short doesn't make it less important.
And we will not elaborate on that. You must sit in wonder about that statement. May it keep you up at night. Okay, so if you have seen this documentary and you have thoughts that you want to share, or you just want to talk about some of the things that we said and chat with us about it, you can reach out to us. We are at Airbuds on all social platforms. And then also you can send us your long, lengthy thoughts and complaints and concerns and dreams in airbuds@gmail.com, because we love to hear from you guys.
We've also had a lot of people commenting on YouTube recently. They post book-level thoughts. We appreciate you. I I see those, I read those, I reply to those, I share those with Piper.
Yay.
What we're going to be doing next week, because I know you guys are sitting around going, what are you going to do next week? Well, we're not quite to a palate cleanser yet. So we are going to be watching the 1970 movie again with George C. Scott. Mm-hmm. We may be having a special guest. We haven't actually asked them yet. But we're going to be rewatching that because we want to and we both like it.
Yeah.
So the other ones we always had reasons to because we thought we'd give it another fair shake. But this one is more just I wanna.
Yeah. Which is great because I found myself the last few months kind of being like, I kind of just want to throw that on again. And like Lillian's there like, wait, no, wait, save the juicy thoughts. And I'm like, okay, fine.
Yeah. Piper just wants to live her life and I want to make a really good podcast.
And I want to talk about the Wright brothers.
I did forget to mention this narrator for this book, this documentary was Tamsin Gerline. I'm going to put it in the chat because I don't trust me at all.
Okay. Yeah. I remember seeing the name and I was like, that's a very interesting name. I don't know.
She's in a bunch of things. You would probably recognize her. I know her from Black Books, which was one of the funniest shows. It was from the early 2000s. So I'm certain that there are jokes in there that no longer align with my values, but it was one of those books, one of those shows where you just sort of die laughing all the time. So I do recommend watching it, but just, you know, if they say bad things, I was a child when I watched it. It's not my fault.
Yeah. I would say her name is Tamsin Gregg, and probably Gregg is actually pronounced a different way. It's Greig. But let's just say Gregg with confidence.
Yep. And if you're British, send us a voice memo with how we're supposed to pronounce that. Don't let us do a Kieran Syrian again.
Or also we got corrected too, that when we were talking about Wuthering Heights, we kept saying Ralph Fiennes and apparently he prefers Rafe. And I'm like, that pretentious jerk would. Ralph Fiennes.
Okay. I mean, I'll try, but who's to say what's going to happen there?
If you got $3 in your pocket and you want to give it to us, you can. We got a Patreon, so you can give us that money. We'll give you some fun little tidbits in return, as well as our love. But yeah, otherwise, we'll see you guys next week. So until then, happy Jane Eyre reading and watching.
Bye.
Bye.